I messed up being prepared with the sweet savor. And aroma would have reference to your nose. Your nostrils would be acceptable to you rather than eyes. So we pray that God would be pleased the sight with us as well. Just want to begin by noting, as we've decided to do with regard to this class, a few review questions, kind of some of the fundamental truths before you. We'll repeat ourselves sometimes. We'll add one or two new ones with regard to the lessons we're having. If you want to feel free to speak out if you know the answer to this. The first one is one we've asked a couple of times. What is Isaiah frequently called? What is the name that is given to him? The Messianic Prophet. That's right. Exactly. And what does the word Isaiah mean?
Salvation
of the Lord, or the Lord is salvation. So that's exactly right. Second question. What are the two main sections of the book of Isaiah? The 39 chapters and then chapters 40 through 66. As related, again, in our material. By the way, that's what I'm getting. That's one of the questions and answers that are given in the material supplied by Mark Copeland. That's the material covering. So you may have a slightly different answer if you studied it independently. But what are the first 39 chapters dealing with primarily? The Assyrian era, and then that means that the Babylonian era would be the section that would be covering chapters 4 through 66. First time I asked this question, how does Isaiah describe his message in chapter 1 and verse 1? What is the statement?
Vision.
It's a vision, and a vision concerning who?
Judah
and Jerusalem. Okay. And then finally, the fourth question, which is also the first time we've asked it, how is the nation described in chapter 1? Look especially in verse 4 of the text.
Sinful
nation, corrupt nation, problems with idolatry and other sins, of course, the brood of evildoers, children who are corruptors, those are problems that we see. So typically with regard to prophets, God raised up prophets when there was rebellion among the people as a means of directing their attention back to God and desire for them to repent. And typically it wasn't successful. And yet God's word is on the record, and we know why God chastises and why he punishes his people. We talked a little bit about that in the first hour, the fact that the nations of Assyria, in this particular case, which took the northern kingdom of Israel, and also brought judgment and chastisement upon the southern kingdom of Judah, though they were not taken into captivity. Later on, with regard to Babylon, taking the southern kingdom of Judah into captivity, that the chastisement that came upon them by these evil nations came upon them because of their guilt, because of their sin. And we will see that this is the case. Now, having said that, we do want to know that as we begin our chapter, with regard to these early messages in chapter 2 and in going through chapter 5 of the text, which is that next lesson, we find that there are a number of things that are talked about. And the first one that is talked about is the glorious future of Israel. The fact that his future will be a glorious future. And, of course, this is what the Israelites, the Jews, in the day of Jesus were looking for. Of course, their perception of that glorious future was not entirely accurate with regard to the teaching that was found in that place in the Old Covenant. But there is a reference to that with regard to the prophecy concerning the establishment of God's kingdom in Jerusalem, his new kingdom, the New Covenant, in verses 1 through 4, where we are told, "It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, 'Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore.'" So this indicates the peace which eventually came and comes through Jesus the Christ, but the establishment of that kingdom. And it is amazing, we talked about this in our study last week, just how closely the words that are found here in Isaiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, comport with the text of Acts chapter 2. On the day of Pentecost, as Jews from every nation under heaven came, and the gospel was sounded forth first in Jerusalem on that day, and then, of course, we know that it spread, and we find, ultimately, with regard to this, of what is referred to as a foreshortening. There are two things to note. Foreshortening would be indicative, I think, of what we might refer to as a figurative language, in the sense that when he talks in this way, it would be inaccurate for us to take that and say everything happened on that one day, that single day on the day of Pentecost. Some of the things happened later. And it seems like that perhaps events that were far removed in the future were spoken of as if they were close together. And of course, we can look at as an example with regard to the establishment of the nations being included in this, not only the fulfillment that was found, the nations being represented by the Jews on the day of Pentecost, but we are also told that when the Gentiles came into play in Acts chapter 10, when the gospel spread forth from the city of Jerusalem to Samaria, to Judea, to the further ends of the earth, we can look at all of the missionary journeys of the Apostle Paul. We can even see the eventual spread of the gospel of Christ to our day, when it indeed is something that breaks down national barriers in every case, as Christians exist in every nation or so many nations under heaven at this point in time, that we see a fulfillment that can indeed be considered something that is more than just something that occurred on the day of Pentecost, more occurring throughout the entirety of these latter days. And I want to give you another example that the Lord alluded to in Acts chapter 2 concerning the prophet Joel in Joel chapter 2. And I'll read from the prophet himself rather than simply Peter's representation of him verses in the text of Acts 2. In Joel 2 and verse 28, we are told, "It will come to pass afterward, I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days I will pour out my spirit. I will show wonders from the heavens and the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, before the great and terrible day of Jehovah comes. It shall come to pass that whoever shall call on the name of Jehovah shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and Jerusalem there shall be those to escape, as Jehovah hath said, and among the remnant those whom Jehovah doth call." This, of course, is used by the Apostle Peter in his preaching on Pentecost to refer to what was happening on the day of Pentecost on that particular occasion, that particular day. But it's obvious as we look at the entirety of the text of Joel chapter 2, it was not all fulfilled on that day. The text refers, in fact, ultimately to judgment as well. I was looking at a representative quote from some of the commentaries that I consult in preparation for this. The College Press commentary had something really good to say on this. He says, "With one dramatic sweep of the brush, this prophet artist has graphically portrayed the entire scope of the Messianic age from its beginning with the pouring out of the Spirit to the working of God during this fearful phenomenon, calling men to repent to the conclusion of the age at the great and terrible day of Jehovah." Just a beautiful expression that he gives there as to what actually was being accomplished in this, which would be another example of foreshortening with regard to prophecy. This happens from time to time. I think one of the reasons why so many religious people today misconstrue the prophets and misunderstand the prophets is, one, they take the prophecies, and I don't say don't take them literally as if they're not, or not take them literally as if they're not going to happen. Language of the prophecy is construed in a literal fashion when obviously and obviously and often these these things are spoken of in symbols, and to not recognize that, that these things may constitute an age or a period of time much longer than that which you often ascribe to it by people who are in religious error. So just kind of want to keep that in mind, because we'll see other examples of that as we go forward in our discussion. So in these first verses of chapter 2, what we find is Zion's glorious future, this new covenant, this new kingdom that would be established in this restoration of Israel to its former glory. You go to the book of Hebrews as an example, you find an epistle which describes that this new covenant, the new kingdom, the new high priest, the new mediator, everything surrounding it is better, actually, than what came before it, but it comes as a result of the remnant. Now you add to that what the Apostle Paul said as an example, that those who are the physical remnant of Israel are not God's chosen, but those who are the spiritual remnant, not those circumcised in the flesh, but those who are circumcised in the heart, which actually is alluded to here in Isaiah chapter 2, when all nations be brought in to this new covenant, this new kingdom. This is something that will be glorious, that that Isaiah gives, in effect, some hope and some good tidings that are yet future for the people of Israel during this time of difficulty, as they were being assaulted by Assyria, as it will be alluded in later chapters in this particular text. So it would be a reference to Zion's glorious future, as indicated by Mark Copeland in his material. Encourage those of Isaiah's day to look forward to with hope of what was going to happen. But then we get into latter verses there, even in that same chapter. Anybody have any questions concerning the prophecy itself and the example of foreshortening or any of these details that we have here in chapter 2? I'll answer them if I can. And if I can't, I'll say I don't know. Anything else? Okay. Well, let us go on then to the next section of our text, which is found from chapter 2 and verse 5 all the way into the fourth chapter, and that is, in effect, that while there is a great glorious future to look forward to, our enjoyment, our joy has to be tempered by the fact that right now we're in bad shape. Israel's present problem, Jerusalem's present problems temper that message of the glorious future, because the present is not so good. He refers to it as the inglorious. Glorious future, the inglorious present. And again, there are different ways of wording these kinds of things, but it's one of the reasons why I'm looking for material here to give to you. I came across Mark's material and kind of liked it, because there are, from these phrases, they're kind of themes that you can remember with regard to chapters and the divisions and such to help you. So kind of keep that in mind, is that first part of chapter 2, we're talking about the glorious future, but in the latter part of those chapters, as we get down through basically through chapter 5, 2 through 5, we're talking about the inglorious present, which is the reason for Isaiah's prophecies on this occasion. So the people of Judah's day, we are told, were being forsaken by God because they had left him. Now, this is an important concept for us to remember. It's one that is revealed numerous times in Isaiah's book, as well as other books of prophecy, is that there is a truth that needs to be kept in mind. Yes, God is chastising, or God has, his presence has left them. They're not going to be protected by him or blessed by him, but it's not his fault or his lack of faithfulness that comes, that brings this about. It's because they have disappointed him. I come to mind in the reading we're doing, those of you who are following the readings, we are in the Joshua right now in the daily readings, and of course we're going to Genesis through. And we're also going to Psalms, or going to New Testament writings as well. So we've gotten to Joshua right now, where we find, for example, the defeat of Jericho. And it was a grand defeat, as they were told to follow after the priest and to walk around the city and to shout, and the walls would fall, and they would completely rout the people of Jericho. But the problem was that while God had told them, when that happens, you destroy them utterly and do not touch the accursed things. And stay away from those kinds of things. But you have a man by the name of Achan who didn't listen, did he? And so he took some of the accursed things of Jericho and hid them in his tent. And so now they go to the next city and they're just ready to pounce on them. Look at the glory. Look at what we've been able to do. And the spies go out and they say, well, people of Ai, they're few. And so we don't need to take everyone. Just take a few thousand to go and let's take that land. And they went before Ai and they were routed. And Joshua was so upset about that. You brought us into the land. You've been able to destroy Jericho, and now you're going to let us be destroyed? You're going to let us be taken? Why has this happened? And God said, it's not my fault, it's your fault. And I left you. I'm not willing to do this because you've got sin in the camp. Until the sin is dealt with, you're not going to have my blessings. And of course, then they dealt with Achan, and they were able to take the city, and the rest of the nation hiccups, of course, because of the sin. But this is the problem that presents itself time and again. It happened with Israel. It happens with us today. It's not that God does not have faithfulness and does not treat us as is fair, but sometimes our own sin separates us from Him. And that is the case here in this particular text. The future hope, what's going to happen is tempered because right now you're in rebellion, as we saw there in verses 6 through 8 of the text. You've forsaken your people, the house of Jacob. They are filled with eastern ways. They're soothsayers like the Philistines. They're pleased with the children of foreigners. Their land is full of silver and gold. There is no end to their treasures. Their land is full of horses. There's no end to their chariots. Their land is also full of idols. And they worship the work of their own hands and that which their own fingers have made. This is a problem. Harlotry, the idolatry, the worldliness, the materialism that was present was causing God to turn away from them. Not that He could not hear, but He would not hear because of the iniquities that they were performing. As you will know, getting a little bit further into the text, just drop down to verse 12 of Isaiah 2. He says, the day of the Lord of hosts. I want to note that phrase because it is used often in the Old Testament with regard to God's judgments or God's chastisement. Whenever you see the day of the Lord, you have to understand the context. Sometimes the day of the Lord has reference to the final day of judgment. It always has some reference to God's judgment upon a people, God's chastisement upon a people, and it is here as well. The reason why the day of judgment on this occasion, contextually, not referring to the final destruction, but rather to the chastisement that would come upon the people at this occasion, the destruction that would come upon the people on this particular occasion, as a result of their idolatry. It comes from God. The context indicates not the final judgment, just the judgment of God and His chastisement. So just kind of keep that in mind when we see that phrase. It is alluded to here in verse 12, and we'll see in a few moments the why of it. But you do have to look at the context to know what the day of the Lord is, that which will come upon them. It would, as indicated in the material, be a time when the arrogant would be humbled, that good leadership would cease to exist, and the women of Israel, this reminds me somewhat of the cows of Bashan, the Ramus, kind of famous statement that is considered very much politically incorrect in our time, but it was the cause of what the women on that occasion were doing and how they were acting, and it seemed very similarly in the description that is given in verses 16 through 24 of the women who were disciplined for their wantonness and for their affectations and all of this particular occasion as well. So let's take the time to read this. Does anyone have any comments or questions up to this point in time that you want to share? Let's then go to make sure that I'm not going. Okay. I sometimes forget where I'm supposed to turn the slide. Let's look in chapter 2 and look at verses 12 through 18. The first point that is made here in this text concerning the arrogant. He said, the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything that is proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, shall be brought low, upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, upon all the oaks of Bashan, upon all the high mountains, upon all the hills that are lifted up, upon every high tower, upon every fortified wall, upon all the ships of Tarshish, upon all the beautiful sloops. The loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The guidance he shall utterly abolish. Again, you can see examples of this throughout all of the existence of Israel. I'm reminded there in 1 Kings in the 18th chapter concerning the contest between Elijah the prophet and the prophets of Baal, and how great the victory of the Lord was on that particular occasion, and the prophets of Baal were slaughtered, and the defeat of Baal as a god, who of course did not exist except in the imaginations of the worshippers, as contrasted with the true God, Jehovah, the Lord of Israel. We see those kinds of things, but it has been always that men have reached a point where they have exalted themselves and everything that they have created, all of the material possessions that they boast of, all of their provisions, everything that they have that they place confidence in will be brought down during the chastisement of God. And that is the case as stated here in this particular text. And, you know, I'm not wanting to be a prophet, not wanting to indicate what is what. There are examples that we can turn to. For example, when we talk about the World Trade Center that existed prior to 2011, was a great edifice, wasn't it? And an amazing thing to look at. And it was a tourist attraction because of its size. We no longer exist. Is that God's judgment? I don't know if that was God's judgment. It possibly could have been a part. Even though they may be, in our mind, they're more wicked than we are, the ones who destroyed that. Well, maybe so. But maybe God used them to judge us. It didn't work very well, did it? If that were the case. And that's often the case with regard to God, that they reject him. Reject God's people. They reject him. Reject God. They no longer retain him in their knowledge, as Romans chapter 1 indicates. And the chastisements fall upon deaf ears, which is why ultimately everyone will be judged, and everyone will be given an account, and the heavens and the earth will be burned up. And then we'll know for certainty, and we will not be able to ignore it. Every mouth will confess that Jesus is the Christ in that final day. But these are opportunities. But we look at those kinds of things. What do we trust in? What do I, as an individual, trust in? Where do I put my trust? Is it in God, or is it in my material possessions? Is it in the people I think who will protect me or are on my side? Is it my government that will protect me against those of another nation? Where do I put my trust? And the lesson is the same for each and every one of us, that lesson must come from God. It can go even, let's not talk about these kinds of physical conflicts. Let's take, for example, the text of James, where he refers to those who said, you know, I'm going to go into such and such a city and buy and sell for a year and make a profit. He said, you shouldn't say these things. What is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little while. What he ought to be saying is, if the God wills, I will do this and I will do that. We are wholly dependent upon God for these things. And that's what he's saying here. People have a tendency to become arrogant. It is an arrogant thing to create gods in your image. It's an arrogant thing to fashion something of wood or stone and then bow down to worship it. It's an arrogant thing to think to yourself that, hey, the way I worship God, because I like it, is going to please him. Because I live my life in a way that pleases me, that surely God is happy for me. All of these kinds of attitudes are present in our world today, just as they were here. And God said, eventually, you're going to come to understand. And you're going to be humbled at that time. And everything about this is going to be humbled at this time. Family, did you have any?
Yes. Just bringing back up a minute ago when you were talking about like the earthly riches and everything like that, it brought to mind the analogy of it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven. And when it says like in verse 17 that the Lord alone will be exalted in that day, that to me just says, like, that's the only thing that matters. Nothing else that we attain in this life or anyone else attains in this life will matter in that day. The only thing that'll matter is Him alone.
Very good point. And with that, with regard to that analogy of the mission, it's hard for a rich man. That is because when we gain things, then we become, it just naturally brings forth that pride and that arrogance. It doesn't matter, but we love it and we think we're special because we have these possessions. But it helps us to exalt ourselves. I've heard it said time and time again with regard to, for example, our own nation, that the time in which more people were interested in the things of God and striving to do right during the Great Depression. I've actually had a couple of older Christians that were passing that time, where they still live. But there are some who lived through the Great Depression who told me what this nation needs right now is another depression. Not because they would want anyone to suffer like they suffered, but they learned some really important lessons when they were suffering as they were. And they learned their dependence upon God when everything is taken from them. Because there is that tendency for us when we receive things. We place our trust in them. We rejoice in them. We become proud because of our possessions or our position or those kinds of things. Even our knowledge and intelligence, all of this kind of arrogant spiritual fruit would be humbled. Now, the next thing I want to do is go to the third chapter. We're not going to read everything. We're not going to discuss every single aspect of every single verse. We said we're not doing this through verse by verse thing, trying to get high points to it. The second thing about God's judgment upon Judah and Jerusalem is because of the ineffectual leadership. The leadership ceases to exist. Now, I want you to notice what's said here. Little thing, maybe perhaps a little bit politically incorrect. This is a patriarchal society. Patriarchal because God has created it in that way. But many will not be willing to accept this. It said, "Behold, the Lord of hosts takes away from Jerusalem and from Judah and the stock and the store, the whole supply of bread, the whole supply of water, the mighty man and the mighty war, the judge and the prophet, and the diviner and elder, the captain of 50, and the honorable man, the counselor and the skilled artisan, and the expert enchanter. I will give children to be their princes, and they shall rule over them. The people will be oppressed, everyone by another, and everyone by his neighbor. The child will be insolent toward the elder, and the base toward the honorable." Base there meaning those who are profane, to the honorable. Notice dropping down in the text of verse 12, he says, "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women shall rule over them." All my people, those who lead you, who cause you to err, destroy the way of your path. The Lord stands up to plead and stands to judge the people. The Lord will enter into judgment with the elders of his people and his princes, for you have eaten up the vineyard, the plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor, says the Lord God? Now, there are a couple of things I want to note from this, and we'll take the last one from the first. And you'll notice the oppression here. I made an allusion to this already. Idolatry is problematic. The immorality that exists in the world is problematic. Now, here in Israel, it was typical with regard to God's chastisement upon people again and again and again. It was in part because the vulnerable were oppressed. And the practice of pure and undefiled religion, as we're told in James chapter 1, is to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction, as well in keeping yourself as water from the world. And we talk about how you see in the political discourse, is it not true that the conservatives often talk about the excesses of the liberals and how wicked they are and the agendas that they promote and how they call evil good and good evil, and how could anyone, and I've heard this so many times from people that I trust dearly, how could anyone be a Democrat in our day and time because of all of the evil? And then they overlook the fact that it is the conservatives that are said by the liberals to have no concern about the poor, of being oppressive to the poor, and all of these horrible things are happening and taking advantage and manipulating and those kinds of things. And you hear, although not too many of our number who would say this, but how could you ever be a Republican and be a Christian? And you hear both things, and truly both sides are bad, aren't they? And that's the way it is in our society today. But this point is made, and I think that it's an interesting thing, because we do we not talk so much about immorality, so much about ungodliness that exists in our culture today, but one of the primary problems with our culture today is the oppression of the poor as well. And while someone may say, well, the poor deserve it, or different things like that, we have to understand that as Christians and as people of God, our responsibility and the responsibility of our leadership is indicated in this particular text to be aware of those who are vulnerable and not to take advantage of them because of their vulnerabilities, because of their poverty. And that was happening at this time. Now, let's say the second thing, or the first thing, which we're going to talk about second, and that is children and women are leaders. Now, I don't want to be politically incorrect in this, and I do want you to understand what is being said here. He talks about men of valor and men of bravery and men of wisdom, great men and valiant men. And this has always been the way in which these things are couched. And so there is a contrast that is given here. Rather than someone who has wisdom and someone who's willing to stand strong and doing what is best and thinking of others more than he thinks of himself, which is, do you remember, what the husband is to do, it's related in Ephesians chapter 5, as God has given him to be head over the home. But instead we have selfishness, and we have weakness, and we have things that are not as they ought to be, that he encapsulates in this imagery of children and of women. It's not to say that women are evil and men are good, and that unfortunately is how it's been construed by many, many generations. And through the superstitious times in the Middle Ages and through history, it's been the woman is not the equivalent of the man spiritually, and that's not the case. And we understand that the New Covenant establishes that very clearly. And the children, the naivety and the innocence of the children, but he talks about children who are insolent to the parents. And you know as well as I do that those who are immature can be manipulative, they can be rebellious, they can be problematic, they need training, they need time, they need maturity, but he said, these are the types that are leading you. These are the types that you're allowing to have access and gain control and be the first in the nation, and it's not the way it ought to be. You have left others. So there is another judgment that will come. Good leadership has ceased to exist in this place, and as a result of that, God is going to chastise them. Okay? Comments, questions? All right, the third thing is found in verses 16 through 24, which is the wantonness of women. Notice in chapter 3 and verse 16, it says, the Lord says, because the daughters. Now, he specifies sometimes men, they're not valiant, they're not as they ought to be. Sometimes he specifies the leaders of the people. Sometimes he specifies the priests. Sometimes he specifies the king. Sometimes he specifies people in general, but yes, he does from time to time specify the women. So this is a problem. And perhaps you can see it. Some of the ladies in the congregation may say, yeah, that's a problem with me, or that's a problem with us as far as tendency. But just see what is happening here in verse 16 of the text. Because the daughters of the night are haughty, they walk with outstretched necks. And when I see that, I think about that pride and me kind of looking down your nose at someone else. Wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, making a jingling with their feet. Therefore the Lord will strike with the scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion. The Lord will uncover their secret parts. In that day the Lord will take away the finery, the jingling anklets, the scarves, the crescents, the pendants, the bracelets, and the veils, the headdresses, the leg ornaments, the headbands. Can you imagine? This is your accoutrement. This is what you have in your boudoir. The perfume boxes, the charms, the rings, the nose jewels, the festal apparel, the mantles, the outer garments, the purses and the mirrors, the fine linen and the turbans and the robes. Do y'all have any of these? I don't think the Western style is probably different than the Eastern, but isn't that amazing? Can you think about your own closet and the things that you have? And how does it cause you to act? Where is the importance that you place upon these things? And that's the question that needs to be asked for us as well. But he says, it shall be that instead of a sweet smell, there will be a stench. Instead of a sash, a robe. Instead of a well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a rich robe, a girding of sackcloth, your branding, instead of your beauty. What you notice, especially in verse 24 in that text. So instead of perfume, there's going to be a stench. Instead of having some beautiful belt or some sash to accentuate your dress, you're just going to have a little rope to put around your waist. Instead of a rich robe, you're going to have sackcloth. That's what you're going to wear. And instead of a beauty mark, remember how the ladies used to put a little black mark on their face as a beauty mark? And my kids, they look at this one on my face, they don't think it's very beautiful. Looking at, especially little ones, they look, I judge it. But the beauty mark, instead you can have a brand. Consider how that is, and consider how this particular thing is characteristic of our day and time too. How about the influencers? Is there on social media? With regard to women, women are primarily the ones that do this, although men can be involved as well. But women are also, are they not, in those kinds of, I watch golf on Facebook and YouTube. I don't watch the influencers. But I know of them. I've seen certain things. But isn't it that they have millions and millions of followers because they've got beauty tips or because of the clothes that they wear or because of some fame that they have gained as a result of their physical appearance? And don't you see that the same kind of things are present today? One of the things that I would like for you to do as we consider about God's judgment upon the nation at this time, why he's doing this, is that a reason for that is because of the problem that existed, but how applicable it is to our nation as well. Making us wonder if maybe we are to the point where God judges us as well. So those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. But understand this, the pure purpose of the judgment was purified. There would be a remnant that would come out of this who would look forward to the blessings of the branch. Isaiah 11 and verse 1, there shall come forth a shoot of the stock of Jesse, a branch out of his roots shall bear fruit. I mean, reference to the Messiah. So the chastisement of God is to bring these individuals low to judge them. And the remnant that would come out of it would be pure, so that they could indeed rejoice in what was to come in the glorious future that would be theirs. Okay? So that's pretty much covered. You'll notice in chapter 2 and verse 5 a couple of statements made about that. O house of Jacob, come and let us walk in the light of the Lord. Chapter 4 and verses 2 through 6 of the text. And that day the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious. Fruit of the earth shall be excellent and appealing for those of Israel who have escaped. It shall come to pass that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who is recorded among the living in Jerusalem, and the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, purged the blood of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment, by the spirit of burning it. The Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion, above her assemblies, a cloud and smoke by day, shining flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering, and there will be a tabernacle for shade in the daytime, from the heat, for a place of refuge, for a shelter from storm and rain. So again, just understand, this is happening, but this is happening again as punishment, but also for the purpose of purification, so that the remnant would be ready for what was to come in that glorious future, as stated, when the branch comes forth. Okay? So actually, I didn't mean to be farther than what we would have gotten anyway. So anybody have any questions about what we've talked about up to this point? Next week, what we will do is go through the fifth chapter, which is basically, it consists of a song. You'll notice in chapter 5 and verse 1, now let me sing to my well-beloved the song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. And in establishing the character of this, which is only six verses long. But he's indicating, again, through imagery, this whole concept of judgment. The Lord is God. The vineyard is Israel, it's Judah, Jerusalem. What he expects of his vineyard are good grapes at the weeds. What instead God gets are wild grapes, which is referring to this rebellion that you see here in this particular text. And so God is going to judge and to destroy the vineyard. That's the whole point that the vision is presenting here in particular text in the psalm. We'll talk about it in a little bit more detail as we get into the last part of our study of chapter 5. And then we're also going to look at the reason for these things as we look at that psalm to Israel in verses, basically verses 8 through the end of that chapter, chapter 5 and verse 30. We'll look a little bit at some of those things. We'll look at the details as we kind of alluded to here. So, evil that he mentions again in this particular text. So we'll basically emphasize for 6 verses in our study, and then we'll get into chapter 6 of our study and go down from chapter 6 in the next lesson just the 6th chapter, we'll talk about the vision of Isaiah as it is related to this particular text. Okay? Appreciate very much the kind attention. I got a little bit wound up there. Sometimes I'll preach instead of teach, and that's just how I am. So we'll pick up with chapter 5 and 6 in our session. Thank you very much for your time.